Next up on the Postdoc Way, our guest is Mark Stout. Mark received his PhD in biomolecular chemistry here at UW-Madison, and he currently is a licensing associate at WRF, which is Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. So I'd like to welcome Mark to the Postdoc Way.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah. So I wanted to start off and allow you to fill in some of the gaps of your experience and your pursuit of higher education and maybe allow you to expand on that a little bit.
Okay, just kind of how I got to where I am?
Yes. Or? Well, I mean, so at some point you did your undergraduate, went to graduate school, and then...
Yeah, I'll just tell a little bit about my story. That'd be great. It's great for the audience to have an idea of what perspective you're coming from. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Texas, went to UT Austin, and there I did a humanities degree as well as a chemical engineering degree, and it was really the chemical engineering degree that I was thinking in my head to get a job with. And then I went and I worked for BASF for a couple years as an engineer. But I really liked that. It was enjoyable. But in the back of my head, like, I always had this notion of what it was to be a professor. You know, this would be such a great job. And I think it was from stupid stuff like Dead Poets Society and some of these, you know, real idealistic notions of sitting, you know, in these crazy Ivy League type places and thinking deep thoughts. I just went back to grad school, probably with about that much thought. I want to be a professor. I should go to grad school. And that's what brought me up to UW. And here I did biomolecular chemistry, so I also mm-hmm. thought it was a good idea to switch, at least at the time I thought it was a good idea to switch completely from engineering to the biosciences, mm-hmm. Because you get a totally different experience, different vocabulary, different way to look at things. And in hindsight, it has helped, but it was a much bigger struggle than I thought initially. Mm-hmm. And through that time in grad school is where I really realized, like, for me, the bench wasn't where I wanted to be any longer. Okay. And that's when I started to explore different options. And it was actually through a seminar that I saw from an internship somebody had that first introduced me to the idea of technology transfer out of universities, where they try to commercialize the technology and inventions that happen at a university. Mm-hmm. And from there, I got an internship at WRF, and then that kind of started my career on that path. And now I've worked at Rice and came back up to WRF as a full-time employee.
Okay. So going back a little bit, sure. Can you describe what your interest in biomolecular chemistry was, or just describe what biomolecular chemistry is?
Yeah, it's basically it's biochemistry. It's just in the medical school, so they give it a different title. But essentially, a lot of these sciences are very similarly related. Okay. Molecular biology and cell biology was a lot of my actual graduate work, I guess. But then even my boss had a partial appointment in medical microbiology. So they're all very closely related, I would say, and it just had a different title.
Okay.
As far as what drew me to it, as I was looking, coming from the chemical engineering side, I had to also look, you know, feasibly what places would take me mm-hmm. as far as, you know, given my background, because I didn't have a lot of the prerequisites. But I knew in biology I was always intrigued by it, and it was such a broad enough field that I felt you could find something interesting to you or to me at that time. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely true. There's so much that goes on in these fields. It's amazing that you have a breadth to work with. Okay. So that's what kind of drew me to the program, the combination of I felt I met some of the requirements, but I felt there would be something in there, even though I wasn't going in completely with eyes wide open, but there was something in there I would like.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find that switch that you made from chem engineering to biomolecular chemistry, was that difficult, or do you think that was more of a seamless transition? Because I remember you mentioning a while ago that you were a lot more in the engineering mindset, and here you're starting to learn essentially from scratch a lot of the biology, a lot of the basic, the essentials, like what DNA, RNA, protein translation, all these things are.
In some ways, yeah, I don't know what UW was thinking when they let me in, because I didn't know the four bases of DNA when I got here. But I never held a pipette in my hand when I arrived at grad school. So you can imagine maybe should have done more homework there. And then also that transition was rough. And what helped, though, was the idea that because I'd done different programs at UT, and it was humanities engineering, but realizing the vocabulary is probably the biggest aspect. Broadly speaking, at least in my opinion, engineering conceptually is, might be said to be more challenging depending on the concepts there. Maybe have more depth to them, but there's not near as many. Mm-hmm. And biology overwhelms you with this tremendous amount of information and then the interconnections between them all. And learning that vocabulary was really the biggest struggle, learning how to speak that language, have good conversations, sound like you at least have a semblance of you know what's going on. So that made the first couple of years rough, but then you picked it up, and it definitely once you got the vocabulary down, I think the transition became much easier.
Mm-hmm. So if... if you had to go through your, I don't know, what it's probably last 6 to 10 years of your life as an academic student and then obtaining your PhD and then transitioning on now to WRF as a licensing associate, what are some of the taglines that you use to identify yourself? I mean, things like, I'm a scientist, I'm a licensing associate, or a tennis player, things like this.
Yeah. I definitely would say two ways to identify it is either I'm a skimmer. I'll talk about the skimmer versus diver. I know you've heard that one, Brian. Mm-hmm. But the idea of where do you like to work? Do you like to know a lot about a little or a little about a lot? Mm-hmm. I'm definitely on the side of a little, knowing a little about a lot. So like jack of all trades, master of none. I think those are some of the types of things that would definitely describe me. Like I said, it reflected in my background that I have a humanities degree, a business foundation certificate, mm-hmm. Engineering, then biochem, and now I work in a world that combines some of those. It's the confluence of business, law, and science and mm-hmm. research.
Okay.
So it served me well here, but for a long time I was floating around trying to figure out what it was because I wasn't the type of person who necessarily had that one thing. Like I always mm-hmm. wanted to be a PI, I always wanted to be a doctor or a fireman. That was never there for me. I was just more of like, oh, look, a shiny. And then I would go look at it for a while and get distracted by something else.
It's kind of like the kid from The Simpsons, always chasing Ralph, always chasing the
butterflies. Yeah, I choo-choo-choo-choo.
So I'm curious, too, when you were, when you still had the dream of this idealistic notion when you were in academia, what was it about the PIs or the mentors that you chose? What drew you to these particular PIs during your PhD program or as an undergraduate?
Yeah, well, as a, like I said, going to graduate school, it was probably, I probably explained about as much thought that went into it as like, oh, I think I want to be a professor, so I just decided to go to grad school. But in choosing my PI once I got here, we do rotations, which I think is probably pretty typical mm-hmm. in a lot of programs. And I think for a lot of these decisions that we have, I think we might undercut the importance of the relationship within them. Especially from the science side, we want to look at the data and have some rational reason. And I could probably give you some. This was a new PI. I thought it would be really neat to see how a lab is set up at the beginning. There would be a lot to learn there. I like the idea of maybe, you know, we've talked about a startup atmosphere, mm-hmm. that in a lab that's just getting going, you have to do a lot of things. As simple as like a refrigerator is getting delivered. We have to find a place for it. Somebody has to be there. We have mm-hmm. to sign for it. Little things like that. But then also a lot of it just came down to, you know, as you meet with these different people, I thought my PI was doing cool science. I thought she'd be a great person to work for and somebody cool to just hang out with and do science. And I mean, that's a lot of the decision when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So there was nothing, I mean, how about as you were going through, were there particular traits or characteristics you were looking for in your mentor? Or I mean, was there anything other than the fact this person was starting up their own lab that drew you to them? I mean, did they have a history of producing graduate students that went on to industry or that went on to academia, or you were excited about the science and that's it?
Well, the science and the person, you know, I just felt like we clicked when I was in there.
Okay.
And I would say I was a little naive too, nothing against Christina, but I didn't think about these type of things because mm-hmm. when I came to grad school, I didn't, for instance, understand the importance of pedigree, which is some of the things you mentioned, looking at like mm-hmm. where are these, compared to a lot of people who probably came to grad school, I was really naive. So those type of things didn't enter into my head. In some way, those are great because you can make decisions free of that mm-hmm. And aren't held to them. And so it worked out well for me. But I didn't actually think of those. This was her first PI position anywhere. She had just come out of a postdoc, so there was absolutely no history. I was technically, since I joined first, I think I was her first grad student by, you know, a couple of weeks of who joins. But the very first one ever. So didn't think of those things and really just looked at the science. And, you know, that I thought I wanted to work with this person and did. And so, you know, that's how I approached it pretty.
Okay.
Pretty, as you said, idealistic. Definitely uh-huh. came in open to that. So.
Okay. So transitioning from this idealistic mm-hmm. standpoint to something more realistic, there's this, you know, sometimes people will keep their blinders on and go straight ahead and pursue the academic route, knowing full well that the likelihood they'll obtain a position is fairly low, but, you know, that might motivate them even more.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, it seems like maybe you came to a realization a little bit earlier than some that you should maybe take charge of your career and push it in a different path. And was there a specific moment or event that triggered or was the catalyst for this as you were going through your PhD program?
You know, I don't think there was a particular moment or, as you said, catalyst. But I think I was lucky, at least in that regard, coming from engineering,
okay.
Because it is a a professional program in a sense. It is preparing for you for a career. They were very oriented to, like, you know, your resumes, getting yourself together for interviews. This notion was always in the back of your mind that, you know, you have some, as you said, take charge of your career. You have responsibility to do those things for yourself and that professional development. So that was kind of instilled in me through that development as an engineer. And then, as you said, you know, as a graduate career moves on and you see some realistic things of, you know, science is unpredictable, or maybe better said, predictably bad, you know, as research often treats us. But, you know, you fight through it. But then you start to look at that long term. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a gradual buildup for me that I realized in around year 4 or 5 that I didn't want to continue doing this. I think part of that was realizing, as you asked me earlier to describe myself, mm-hmm. as, you know, jack of all trades or skimmer versus to deep dive and to be the world's expert on X, mm-hmm. that also I realized that isn't what I wanted to be, not where I like to work. Mm-hmm. So slow realizations for me, but they started to simmer. And then I really figured it out about year 5 or 6 and started, as you said, to look at different opportunities, start to see what may be out there. And it's one of those things. Sometimes when you don't know what the answer is, but you know what the answer isn't for you. Right. And so you got to eliminate some things, same as science. So you may not know what the right answer is yet, but you know it's not A, B, and C. So that helped me to start looking in a different direction.
Okay. And was this something you proclaimed to everybody, or did you feel the need to keep it a secret from your PI and your committee members and those around you?
I was pretty lucky in that regard. At least, especially toward the end, you know, saying coming up to the dissertation. Maybe at first I kind of, you know, was still riding that fence and, you know, would just talk about it to my, like, good friends in lab or whatever, like, what do you think? And the same way you commiserate with your fellow postdocs or, you know, graduate students. Because, you know, it's a hard thing to get through. But as I moved on toward approaching my dissertation, I did have open conversations with my boss, and I think that was one of the neat things with them being new and fairly, I mean, they had just come out, like I said, their first lab, they had just left postdocs. I think she was very open to that idea that there are other careers out there and supportive of it. So that was really nice. And for me, that went well. I know other people may not have that experience. So I was lucky in that regard. That's also partially when you want to work with somebody, as I was thinking there, the younger PIs have a different view of both that and application of their science, generalizing here, but often that's the case. And so that helped me out that it wasn't as a taboo subject as it might be in other labs.
Okay. And do you feel that your PI was generous with her network and trying to help you move on to a position that you're interested in after you left the lab? Or was it something that you essentially had to figure out on your own and develop a network from scratch?
Yeah, I think I've naturally, I guess, kind of developed networks. So I think a lot of it was probably on my own. I think my PI was very open to that and would have been supportive, but naturally her networks, from her being in academia and being at a D1 research school, her networks were different than where I was looking.
Right.
So I think she'd have been more than happy to help. And I think she did connect me with one person maybe to have an email conversation with. Okay. But just naturally her connections weren't in the places I wanted to go, so I had to work to develop those through other avenues, either former coworkers or just some, you know, open-ended informational interviews with people.
Okay, and it sounds like, was this before or after LinkedIn really became essentially the yeah. stop, you know, the one-stop shop for networking?
Gonna date me now. yeah, LinkedIn was just getting rolling then. I know I was on it and everything, but it wasn't utilized in the same fashion I think it is today. I mean, because now this would have been, geez, 4, 5, 6 or so years ago, okay. I'm guessing, somewhere in that time frame.
Yeah, so you did more or less the ground and pound, kind of getting out there, shaking hands and conversing with people at you know, either over email or from informational interviews over lunch or coffee, something like that.
It was, but I don't know. There's some debate. I think always, like, personally, I'll say I like to leverage networks through those individual nodes. So, like, you'll be surprised, even as you're talking about, as the postdoc way grows, mm-hmm. how one friend of yours will tell another friend and then maybe talk about it at a place. And all of a sudden, that grows very quickly. It's amazingly powerful how those networks can go and really how many people are within your reach. And so it wasn't necessarily going to a convention and just, you know, cold handshaking somebody. Hi, you know, I'm Mark Stout. How's it going? I'm still amazed at how kind people are when you do that. So it's not out of the realm of possibility by any means. But I think traction-wise, when you have a friend who maybe has a friend and you can say, like, hey, right. so-and-so recommended I talk to you, mm-hmm. those are much more powerful. And then you'll be surprised how often, even if that's not the end of the step, when you have that informational interview, they might recommend 2 or 3 other people that mm-hmm. you talk to who are friends of theirs.
Right.
And then it can grow.
Right.
And to let it grow organically like that, I think, is what the approach I take for sure.
Okay. So, how did the buzzword or the phrase tech transfer come across? You know, when you're in your PhD program, how did that come across, or how did you hear about that? And then from there, what really led you to believe that this is something you want to pursue and find out more about, and maybe even look for positions in this field?
Yeah, that's a great point. I've been using that, and I mentioned vocabulary, how important it is, and I forget sometimes the vocabulary that each of us takes for granted in our own individual areas. But tech transfer, I think I mentioned at the beginning, basically we work to commercialize the technology and the inventions at the university. So that's what I do. But I worked in a very basic research lab. I had heard nothing of this. I happened to be in a fellowship. It was an NIH biotechnology training program, BTP. And in that program, they had their fellows do interns. I didn't have to because I had already worked in industry. So I actually opted out of it. Because I already had industrial experience. But in those, when people came back from their interns, they would give a seminar. We gave research seminars as well as seminars on the intern experience, what they felt about it, what they learned, how it was like. And it was through one of those. Somebody gave one. They had interned at Wharf, which is a technology transfer office for the University of Wisconsin. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of this. But it sounded really interesting, especially as I was starting to think in my head of things away from the bench, that I still like the science, want to be involved with it. But, what options, what types of things are out there? And there's really a whole lot. But that was my introduction to it through that seminar. And then later, when I talk about networks, when I finished my graduate career, I'd applied for different things, still waiting to hear back from those, some in the government, some fellowship programs like presidential management fellows, different ones, mm-hmm. different types of things. And a former, I barely knew her because she was leaving as I was coming in, but she worked in my department. So a fellow graduate student, barely crossing paths as we were coming and going into our graduate careers, but she worked at Wharf.
Okay.
Set up a lunch, talked to her, and I think I owe her, Vic Sutton is her name, and I think I owe her a whole lot because I think she got my resume looked at as well.
Okay.
She can't get you the job, but she can make sure at least like, hey, I think you're a good candidate. I remember working with you.
Right.
Let me at least make sure your resume gets to, at least in front of the eyes of the hiring committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was able to get an internship at Wharf, and that's really what got my foot in the door and set things rolling.
That's great. So an internship was the next path.
It was for me, yeah.
So is this, did you secure your internship while you were in your PhD program, or was this your next step after you defended your thesis and you took on an internship?
It was after for me, and I was lucky that it was a paid internship. I didn't pay a lot. I think it paid even less than a graduate student. I remember I ate canned soup for a fair amount of that time. I think my apartment was like 340 square foot or something. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, it was something small. But, it was key in making that transition step. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about before, like having a plausible narrative of why I'm interested
right.
in this.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm getting my start in this, that I really have a little bit of experience, just enough of a narrative hook to be able to tell your story to people
mm-hmm.
That is at least plausibly acceptable of how you arrived at where you are and where you at least think you'll be going at the time.
Okay. And so in terms of a starting point that one would need to maybe grab hold on in the tech transfer area, do most people start with an internship? And then, can you describe the process, the most common process that people use to get their foot in the door at a tech transfer?
That's an interesting question because I think it's changing. I think a very common thing for a tech transfer people in the tech transfer field, or if you ask them right now, people who are currently in it, all of them kind of, in a sense, fell into it. Like, I heard about it, like, oh, that's neat, and here I am. And now there actually is, more people just in the world, I think, for anything. People are actually looking at this and know about it ahead of time and are actually preparing themselves, perhaps because they want to go into this specifically. So it might be changing a bit. But I think for any job, but especially transitions, having some kind of foot in the door, whether it's a volunteer or internship, really speaks volumes. And it's really, even if it's just to have it on your resume, when I mentioned vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
when you work around it for a little bit, the same way you join a new lab, and the first couple lab meetings are like, you're like, oh my God, what's going on? And then you start to calm down because you know the words. It's like, oh, they're just talking about X. But
mm-hmm.
you can have conversations, and your conversations will be different.
Right.
And the minute you have that vocabulary, you gain credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of exposure, like I said, a volunteer opportunity, I think, is a great way. internship if they're available. But oftentimes, I think you have to be prepared to, in a sense, take a step back before you can move forward. And hopefully your training in your graduate career, which you'll, while you may be jaded about it at the time, I mean, I know I went through my ups and downs like everybody did, but it does pay dividends later because you approach problems, information, acquisition of knowledge much differently. And I think if you're willing to take that little bit of a hit, people often find that they can then accelerate their career path quicker than others without that experience through graduate career.
That sounds like a very common theme that I've heard multiple people say mm-hmm. now. If you want to get your foot in the door, you need to be prepared maybe to take a step back just to rub elbows with the right people, learn the language of the company or the office that you want to work in, and make sure that you're in good graces with the people that will be reviewing you if you're coming up for maybe a job position or something like that, mm-hmm. or putting your resume on the right person's desk. So as an intern, what kind of job responsibilities did you have? What was your title as the intern at Wharf?
I think I was a licensing intern. They don't have grandiose titles, where it's kind of like the opposite of my graduate career. Biomolecular chemistry sounds to me much more impressive than it is. You know, it's just biochem, but then mm-hmm. they needed to make up a new word, so that's what they rolled with. But Wharf is very, very simple in their title. So licensing intern is what it was. And okay. so I contacted potential licensees, helped write descriptions of technologies as they would come in that were non-disclosing. So they were didn't have to be kept confidential so that we could send them out to people. Had conversations with licensees about their interests, what would be a good fit, what type of stuff do they need in their business to be successful. Do we consider them qualified, such that do they have... One of the big drives for us is not... and this is where I like the idea of what I do is still related to academia and that broader thing of the public good, because mm-hmm. That's also in some notion why I came back, you know, because
right.
I could do the same job in industry and get paid more than I get paid at Wharf, you know, but it's a different job, different benefits and costs, you know, to what you may want to do with your life. But with Wharf, I think it definitely has a drive, I think, that can drive commercialization forward. And so one of the things isn't necessarily the bottom line. That like if a company X is going to pay me maybe like $5 million for this technology and another company, you know, can only give half that amount, but they're actually a good partner and they want to commercialize it, where the first company simply wants to put it on a shelf mm-hmm. and not let it get out to the world. That's not our goal. Our goal is to get the technology out to the world to help people in some fashion, either through a product, therapeutic, whatever it is. So that's a nice way to approach that. And then so we were looking for these applicants or these licensees. Did they qualify as a good commercial partner, okay. we call it, whether they're a qualified licensee or not.
Okay, and is that essentially a starting point or one of your branching points for what you currently do as a licensing associate now?
Yeah, it's actually very similar. I just have more responsibility and I handle it to a greater level of detail and a responsibility. You know, I have authority now to make certain decisions myself, of course, as an intern, you know. I mean, but that's how you learn these things, to be able to move along.
Okay. So what is the day in the life of Mark Stout like? If you wake up on Monday and just walk me through your day, or is it changing from Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday, or is it pretty much the same thing, something that you can describe, I guess, maybe a day or a week?
Sure, I'll do both, and then I may add something on the end, because Wharf is unique in its setup. So I'll talk a little bit about that, but I think a lot of it, too, I'll talk about it, is perspective, because I think you can describe a lot of things, like being a medical doctor, perhaps. Every day you're basically somewhat doing the same thing, you know, but you're working with different people, you have a different set of circumstances. So, and that's similar in my own regard. I'm looking at contracts, I'm making phone calls, I'm going through emails, but I'm looking at different technologies through the week, different professors, different whole different sectors of the market. I mean, I'll look at stuff from like ice cream machines to nanocomposites to the other day we had a crusher of shells to be able to be put into building materials and like literally shells of like mollusks and stuff like that. So it really runs a wide gamut that keeps it very interesting. So for me and Wharf, we have an IP team and a licensing team.
Okay.
Where some tech transfer offices handle it cradle to grave, like where I worked at Rice, so they do everything. Here at Wharf, the IP side work more with the USPTO and handle what's called the prosecution of the patent. So trying to get the patent through the office, the USPTO, to be able to get a patent issued. So they're working on what they call office actions and doing their thing. My side is more like business development. So on an average week, what I do at Wharf, there'll be a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, but I'll be working with... licensees and potential licensees, trying to get them in contact with a professor so they can have conversations, especially their scientific teams. So getting confidentiality in place, talking with a licensee, trying to figure out what do they really need, what is their goal, what is their business plan, evaluating that business plan. Does it look like they have the right developmental milestones? Have they thought about this? You know, if you're trying to get a therapeutic out and no mention of FDA is anywhere in there, you know, we have a problem. You know, if it's not realistic, if they think, oh, we'll have FDA approval in 6 months, again, you know, that's huge red flags. You know, you look at their finances. Do they have the resources to be able to take their project to completion, or at least reasonable expectations that they will be able to gain the funds needed to? And so day to day, it's a lot of phone calls. I would say conversations and meetings, and mixed in with those. Or meetings with faculty. And those are some of the most fun to me, because at that point, that's when a new invention is coming in. And really, the IP team is a lead for this meeting, but the licensing team also usually accompanies it. And a lot of other places where they handle it cradle to grave, it would be the same person. You're just one and the same. But that's when the inventors, whatever that team is, it'd be students, grad students, professors, come in and they're telling you about what they think they've discovered. And you get to have a conversation, and the world's expert have to explain it to where I understand it, which is pretty amazing to me. So put it in terms that I get it, that I can understand what the novel aspect of it was, what separates it potentially from what's out there. And then we evaluate that. So to broaden it even from a week, once a month, we're in a cycle at Wharf to where we evaluate those technologies that come in. We evaluate it in two ways. The IP team is looking at whether it can be patented, which is almost more of a legal type term. It's regulations and laws involved in it as well. But, you know, it has to be novel, not obvious, and useful. So does it meet these criteria?
Okay.
Do we think we can get a patent? And then the marketing side also looks at the idea of, is there a market there that is able to be used? Well, let's say patents are fairly expensive, so we have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that we use the money wisely. So we're kind of laying down bets here that we think this is going to be a technology that we'll be able to get some benefit from and be able to benefit the world. If the market is not there, maybe great science, but maybe that's not something we want to spend the money on, but we can have it reach the market in different ways. So looking at that market and IP decision, another thing that happens every month, like I said, and so in the particular week I'll be preparing for this, making my justifications of the market size is X, we think we might be able to capture Y, it's a this much improvement over the known technology. And so I'll be looking on the internet to research these different markets and industries to try to get that information to make a recommendation on whether we should accept those technologies in the portfolio or not.
Okay.
So sorry that wasn't quite week by week, but...
Sounds like a very, very unique dynamic of day to day.
It's very diverse. It's easier to talk about like I said, overall month or the overall concept of what I do, and then each day's dynamic can vary a great deal. Yeah. I mean, like this Monday, I'm going to visit a bunch of cranberry farmers, so we're going to go up to their sites to see how they operate, stuff like that. A week ago, I went up to a conference that was an analytical chemist, because we had a professor to present there. And after he presented, there were companies there that we spoke to afterwards and have a couple leads. Hopefully something will come from it. We'll see.
That's cool.
So those type of events also happen.
So the three, I could probably figure out some of the likes of your career just in what you've been talking about now.
Yeah.
But if you want to expand on, you know, the three things you love most about your job and then three things that you don't like as much or that you maybe are working on changing.
Yeah.
If you can expand on those, I'm curious.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think I'm usually at a loss for words. Probably goes well with this job, being able to interact with people, I think is hugely important. And basically my role is a liaison between the industrial world and the academic world. I work at that interface to get the two cultures talking and on the same page. So yeah, being able to talk is helpful. But as far as likes, I like that I'm close to the research still. I get to see a lot of science. I'm not doing it myself. So I don't know if you combine
that.
I do every now and then, but I think it's the type of thing that if I got a job that went back to it, I bet after like a month, I'd be like, oh man, you know, maybe even a week. But there are times I do miss it. In fact, when we get to like some of the dislikes, a portion of that I definitely think about. But here I get to stay close to the research. I interact with amazing people. You're still with academia, some of the leading world's expert of this, which is really amazing. I get to see tangible work products as far as we get a license deal done. Mm-hmm. And the time frame can be long, but it's not necessarily like, you know, 4 years to get to a paper or 3 years. So it's a little bit more digestible chunks that you mm-hmm. feel like, okay, I've accomplished something and I can move on to my next task. And then the quality of life, I think, is something that speaks to as well, that there's a balance. And I think this isn't necessarily particular to this job. Some jobs are different, but it's very different from grad school for people who are listening to there. I've heard even a transition to a postdoc. I never actually did a postdoc myself, mm-hmm. but that you have a little bit more balance of, like, the lab doesn't necessarily own me. In this job, there is that notion. I mean, sure, I have events I have to go to in the evening, mm-hmm. but often I can work that around if I need to have somebody else go. And basically, day-to-day, it's not like if my cells didn't come to the OD, I get to stay till 9 o'clock wow. at night or 1 o'clock in the morning.
Hard to find.
Yeah, well, I don't miss that. So I definitely like that that's not a part of my life. But dislikes, I think you touched on at least one aspect do I miss. And even from being an engineer, there's some aspect to my job that, like, I help facilitate the structure of the deal. I help make sure we have a good plan going forward. But in that sense, you kind of hand it off, and then it's somebody else's baby. And they actually drive that product or that technology forward. Mm-hmm. And there is a twinge in me, definitely, now and then. It's like, oh, you know, wouldn't that be neat to really get involved with that and push it forward? That's something that is not a part of my job. And as you said, you know, working to change it, that's just the nature of it. I don't think it will ever be that way. You stay in contact with them, but you won't be involved in the same way you would be with a startup that it's like, your actual technology and your mm-hmm. project you're pushing forward. Again, given your what you like and don't like, there's a ton to know. You have to be very comfortable in asking what are probably stupid questions often, but hopefully in an intelligent way. But you have such a breadth of material to cover. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly know it all. And you're talking to the person who is the expert yes. in it when you're talking to a professor. You need to be comfortable with that because it can wear on you, I think, depending on your personality, that, like, your comfort level might be different, where after you work in a lab for 4 years, you really know that material pretty well, and you know it better than, like, 99.9% of the people in the world. This job is not like that. There's always new stuff coming in, but as much stuff as a university can invent, that will always be the case. It's also, as opposed to industry, the salaries are a little lower, and the organizational structure is flat. So if you're the type that likes to climb a career ladder, like, up the rungs, may not be a great fit for you. But, you know, there's other benefits on the other side, depending, you know, it's just what you like. But those are some of the things that I would definitely say are, you know, like you say, some of the drawbacks and some of the things that, you know, if you could change, you might. I think other tech transfer offices, again, and Wharf might be an exception, but sometimes you may not have the full staffing you would like.
Okay.
And that can, you can get overwhelmed. I think at some offices, I talk to colleagues who are definitely drinking out of a fire hose. And, you know, that can eventually wear on you as well, you know, as a type of job. But I hope as this interface grows, I think hopefully some of those offices will be staffed better. But I think that's definitely a fair statement to make.
Okay. And so I've got two really important questions here for you. Yeah. And hopefully this is where you had a chance to think about these a little bit more. The first one is, would you, now seeing the breadth of your career where you're at now, would you have done anything differently? And then the second one is, do you find a value, where you're at now, do you find a value in having your PhD, or is this something that you think you probably could have done or maybe transitioned to in a career without the 5-6 years that you spent as a PhD?
The first one is always an interesting question because, and I may throw it a little back at you, you know, like a good politician, I'm happy where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as when you're there, so I think it comes from a place where you can't always say later, you know, like, so would I change it? Well, I don't know if I'd be here, so I'm happy where I'm at. So would I change anything? You know, it's that prosaic answer people give, like, no, I wouldn't change anything. But realistically, I mean, like, I don't know that going straight into biology was great. Actually, engineering degree may have a more, I don't know if prestige is the right word, a little more mm-hmm. weight to it. Because
right.
Actually I find in some of my applications, my undergraduate engineering degree, people are arguably more interested in that than my PhD in the biosciences. So that might be like one thing. And as you said, going to grad school, when you look at the opportunity cost of those years of your life, both personally as well as like financially, you know, when you look at time value of money and retirement, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are difficult things that when you look back, I mean, would I do it differently? I mean, if you just totally gave me a tabula rasa, I think you even mentioned like your interest in these types of things is, mm-hmm. as you look forward, like I would have loved to have known more programming, And got into computers a little more than I did. And I just missed that by a year or two when it really got incorporated into the engineering curriculum. But I think that would have been invaluable, just even in day-to-day tasks in the lab when I was there. The minute you do a task like, you know, maybe 10 times, you know, I had a friend who could write like 2 lines of code, and mm-hmm. it's just done for him every time, you know. And I'm like, wow, you know, that would have been really nice and paid a lot of dividends. On the second part of your question was, I think, what is the value mm-hmm. that the PhD, or and you asked, is there any that it brings to my job?
I assume there is some, but yeah. I'm just wondering globally, you know, you as an outsider now kind of looking in and seeing people going through their PhD and postdoc years and seeing all these wealth of opportunities out mm-hmm. there, do you think there is still value in the years that you spend obtaining that PhD or maybe even doing a postdoc, or would you suggest that maybe making a transition, doing an internship, or just making connections earlier on would allow you to pursue a path that, you know, maybe would be better spent?
I think the PhD definitely helps me in my job mm-hmm. In the sense that we mentioned vocabulary, and there's also a certain stance of, like, in my job, I work with inventors and professors, and so a lot of the inventors might be scientists, so they have their PhD themselves. A lot of my contacts in the business world may as well, and what you find is you have a different conversation once they're both aware that you have a PhD, which sounds horrible, but it's some just camaraderie. Mm-hmm. You've kind of been through it, you know. Yep. And you'll have different conversations, so I think that level of conversation that you can have with a PI is very valuable, and without a PhD would probably be a little different. In the idea of postdocs, I can't speak as directly to that because I didn't do one. The only difference there I might note is you aren't necessarily adding credentials in the same way. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to, make a recommendation on something I haven't done. But what I might think in my head if it was me as I was going through it is that when you're looking for that Fisher Cup bait point, start to evaluate... I say Fisher Cup bait. It's never a one-way track, too. I mean, a lot of things lead to it. I'd say in my job right now, it's not as obvious. Tech transfer, like if you go on the websites that are the organizations for what I do, there might be like 20 or 30 jobs open in the country right now. Mm-hmm. So it's not huge. But there's a lot of doors that can open. They just aren't as obvious, say, as right. if you're a nurse or a teacher, where if you type that into like monster.com, you get like 1,000 hits. Mm-hmm. Our type of work isn't like that. Same with a PhD, but you actually have an amazing amount of skills you've developed that if you can package in the right way and look for those doors, there's a lot out there. So when I think of the postdoc, the only difference would be like to stick it out and finish my PhD when I figured out maybe year 4 or 5, like, wow, man, I don't know if this was like the right path for me. It was worth it to finish that out to have that credential and then have the different conversations that I'd have now. And it also pretty much removes the ceiling from you in most organizations, that there's not an upper limit necessarily to where you can go if you have that. And really, it's just a credential. I mean, we've all been there. We know the behind the curtains more than most people about what it may or may not be worth, really.
Right.
But it does do that for you, which is really important. Postdocs, they aren't doing that in the same way. Mm-hmm. So I might look at those a little more critically of my time, of how they're advancing me to where I want to go.
Right. That completely makes sense. So now that we've established there is value in your PhD and the years you spent getting your PhD, was there a particular skill or set of skills that you felt you can only learn in your PhD program that you wouldn't have got anywhere else that is extremely important for where you are now?
You know, I'd have to say no, really. But that's just the way I view stuff, because I think a lot of the world, especially now with, like, the Googles and everything, mm-hmm. like, one of your questions you had is a potential might be, like, what kind of resources are out there. I think a lot of stuff is on you in this mm-hmm. world today, and that's good and bad. You know, like, your parents maybe joined a company and worked there for 30, 40 years, and that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. Here, you get to recreate yourself over and over if you'd like to. And in a way that's freeing, in a way that's a hell of a lot of responsibility on
right.
you. You know, it's on you. So could I have learned these same things in another way? Sure. I mean, look, there's people like Steve Jobs. There's people who never went to college mm-hmm. and learned amazing skills just on their own. At the same time, I think there's a lot of ways that the scientific method teaches you to look at data, to be a critical thinker. That might be the biggest thing that it hones in on. Being a critical thinker and being able to apply that to a breadth of problems that maybe... how would I say, you know, it's not a defined problem, because mm-hmm. that's the nature of a PhD. You push the knowledge to someplace it hasn't been, mm-hmm. You know, whatever, however small that niche may be, like mine, if over 10 people, if it ever reached double-digit people that ever looked at my paper, it would be a miracle. But, you know, with that notion, I pushed that little bitty mm-hmm. corner of the world forward a fraction of a hair. But that type of thing, I think, is important, that you'll be able to take a problem. You know, as companies move forward, problems exist that they can't anticipate. You probably have more comfort in that than most people in the world, because you had to face that on a daily basis, trying to get a protocol to work that nobody's ever done, trying to figure out what's wrong when it's like 10,000 variables that could be the issue, and really picking those apart. The critical thinking, and maybe three things. Critical thinking, being able to work with problems and teach yourself whatever you need to learn to solve that problem and have the comfort to do that. And then the last thing I think that most people agree with is you learn to deal with failure, because that happens a lot too, and fight back from it. And some people really just, you know, for whatever their lucky life has happened, they haven't had to face that a lot. Mm-hmm. When you first face that years later in a corporate setting maybe, or whatever setting it may be, I think that just pays a lot of dividends to be able to handle yourself well when it does, and know you can pick yourself up and you'll find another way to solve it.
Okay.
So I don't know that the PhD is the only way to learn those, but those are definitely valuable things that come from it.
Okay. Now switching gears for the last two questions, I wanted to ask you if you had the opportunity, or if you were now putting on a different hat as a career counselor, or you were the academic advisor, what would you tell your trainees, either your PhD trainees or your postdoc trainees, knowing what you know now? If for some reason you transition back into academia and you have this, you know, this new sense of what else is out there, how would you advise your trainees?
So I'm in like a PI position?
You're now a PI or okay. a career counselor and okay. academic counselor.
Do I have tenure?
You do have tenure.
Oh, then I can tell them anything I want, right? Yeah. But yeah, let's see. That's a great question. I would try to step them along. I'm trying to think back to mine. I would want to have a balance of safe and risky projects for them to make sure they're developing along their way. And I think I would start small and build on it rather than trying to overwhelm, because I think there's a lot of transition. Types of things I would tell them. I think... would I be honest? I was trying to think, would I really let them know, like, you know, like think about some of these statistics. I think I definitely would. I would. I think nowadays, and I think a lot of new PIs do this, I would have that conversation with them about, like, what are the odds of this, you know, happening? You know, like, this is a great endeavor, but let's think about this. And I think it's from my engineering background that it was much more career oriented. And I think I would take that with me as a PI, you know, like, what are we doing here? Where do you want to be? How can we help you get there? You know, why you help me as well to get what I need.
Right.
And I'd like to strike that balance between them. I have things that I would need as a PI to get my tenure and to mm-hmm. drive my science forward. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to balance that with hopefully direct it toward something that may be leading them to where they want to go as well, and have those conversations. And I really would, as a PI, I would ask them here and there. I even like evaluations, but this is from my corporate background. You know, like have some of those questions, which I think mm-hmm. are very foreign in the academic world, but right. I would probably bring that in. I know one professor who did this, and it's annoying, but it makes you think right. about what you may want and think about that question. And I think that's good to have, because then hopefully you have happier grad students who then, you know, hopefully for you, produce better work and you have a better relationship moving forward.
See, now we're really going to test if this was planned or not. So are you familiar with MyIDP?
Oh, I have heard of that.
Oh, you have heard
yes.
of it. But it's not something that while you're answering the question you were completely thinking about. Or
No.
Compact. So exactly what you described is something that one of our other guests had co-authored. It's called MyIDP. It's an individual development plan, essentially,
oh, okay.
to go through. The idea is to go through with your PI and yourself. It's a skills assessment. It mm-hmm. essentially puts things into context of what you're good at, what career options you may be interested in pursuing. It kind of bins things out for you. And the idea is that you, before you start your training program, you sit down, you fill this out, and then you show this to your PI and say, this is where I'm at, this is the kind of training I would like. And it becomes more of a symbiotic relationship between you and your PI. Your PI understands that you're there for a particular type of training, but also should understand that while you may not want to be an academic faculty member, you may want to pursue another path at this PhD or this postdoc era few years that you're spending is going to be important. So just as you answered, I think is a perfect answer. You want to maintain a balance with your postdocs and be able to assess what their skills and what their strong points are and where they'd like to go forward. There's also a compact that, at least for postdocs, that one can sign. And again, it's something similar. It's promises that your PI makes to you based on your skills and what you want to do and then what your postdoc agrees to do for you in the time allotted. Maybe it's a contract of 4 years, 3 years. But essentially, the whole idea is that you review each of the benchmarks and the milestones after 6 months or a year and say, do we meet these? Where do we go as we're moving forward? So taking all that into context, it sounds like you would be well-versed as a PI, maybe.
I don't know.
It
isn't going to happen, but maybe I just found a blind squirrel finds a nut, right? Maybe I just lucked on a good answer as I was scrambling there. But I like the idea that is happening. It's great that you guys, because I had never heard of that before. Like I said, I heard of the IDP notion before, but I didn't know that was being incorporated into some of these things, as a structure.
I like that. Supposedly becoming mandated by NIH before people can apply for training grant programs. Huh. So I think that's really important. And your former PI is also a big advocate of these skill assessment plans as well.
At first, I have to go talk to her. I hadn't talked to her in a while. But when I first asked for him, she was kind of like, okay. And, you know, I think she was a little more taken aback, but I had just come out of industry. Right. So it was like, for me, I'm like, I want my performance review now to see, like, what have I done well? What can I work on? How can I get there? Because I worked for BASF. I mean, that's how it worked in a large organization. You know?
Yeah, that is extremely important. So the last question I have for you is, you know, again, taking everything into context and understanding what you needed to do to get to where you are, what kind of advice would you give to somebody, maybe as an undergraduate or somebody in their PhD program that's really interested in becoming a licensing associate or somebody that's interested in transitioning to tech transfer?
Oh, goodness. I have no idea what you're doing and bounce around for a while, right? I mean, that almost seems like what's happened. You can approach the job from any of the three disciplines, at least conceptually, business, law, or science. But I think the science is the most common background because most people feel that that might be the hardest one to pick up if you haven't had exposure to it. So often I see the offices, they'll hire people with science backgrounds and then teach them the business that they need. Or later, if you go to a law school, if you're doing IP law, you need a science background to be able to get a patent, to pass the patent bar. Actually, to be eligible to sit for the patent bar, you have to have a science background. So some type of science background is really important. And this is a trade-off. I think it's risk-reward, like a lot of things in our life, that in some sense, the jack of all trades doesn't have the same value in our society. It's good for this job, but it might be a little risky in the sense of it makes you applicable in a lot of things. But let's look at like an IP lawyer. Mm-hmm. They're very skilled, or even a PI. They're very skilled in what they do. You know, as you do your postdoc and you look at some of those applications. I remember I looked when I was graduating as a PhD. You know, they're looking for somebody who worked on, like, bone morphogen antigen 2 or something. And you may have worked on number 1 or number 3, I don't know, whatever, another one out there. But they actually find somebody who worked on the exact one they want. That's, like, how specific they can be, potentially, in looking for that. At least that was some of my experience. It's very, very tunneled down. Now, when they find that person, you're the perfect fit. And maybe your potential reward is greater, you know, that, like, that expertise is highly valued. For IP lawyers, get paid a lot more. But the trade-off might be, when something happens to your position and you're around looking, in the same way you've narrowed yourself down into a very specific place. So it's a trade-off, and that was a roundabout way to say, I would go for a varied background really helps you here. Some little foundation in business, some little exposure to it, but being able to speak to a lot of different groups mm-hmm. and a lot of different types of technologies are important for my particular job. But that might be risky depending where you're headed down. I'm just taking a thinking. If I'm really thinking for a second, I'd actually do what I did, go figure. I think an engineering degree is an amazing degree to have. I know a ton of friends are former engineers. Mm-hmm. But that degree carries a tremendous amount of weight around places. So if you get in and you like it enough to make it through, I think that opens just a tremendous amount of doors, and you can do kind of what you want after that. So I think that's what helped me out the most. And there's other sciences that are similar, but having that science background can do it. So actually, I'm probably going to retrograde here a bit and say I would focus on something. And maybe that's what gets your foot in the door. I'm the expert on X. I'll learn the rest. That's probably a safer way to do it now that I think about it. I happen to move around a lot, and that's helped me. I think that may have been a lot of luck as it worked for me. A safer way would be to go to find something, develop that expertise in one scientific discipline. And they do hire, say, for instance, they'll hire a physical science person. They hire a biological person. Maybe they hire somebody from computer science. Mm-hmm. So they do focus in on a particular area, broadly speaking, though. Okay. It's not that, like, you're I don't even know an example in good programming languages nowadays. CSS is probably dated like crazy, but whatever it is, or HTML, they don't necessarily, they aren't hiring an HTML coder, right. But they want you to know the concept of coding, the mm-hmm. concept of computer science, what's important. And they will hire in those type of sectors.
Okay. So before we say our goodbyes, I want to ask you one more question kind of on the spot here. I've heard a lot of these vocabulary terms thrown around, or phrases, these turn of phrases that you keep throwing around that I assume are mostly from your upbringing in Texas, right?
Maybe so. Yeah, it depends which one.
So you've worked at least five of them into the conversation, if I've been counting correctly. So what are your top three favorite turns of phrases from Texas, or that you use very commonly that you don't hear a lot of other people using?
Oh, God.
Because you mentioned something about drinking from the fire hose earlier. I have
never heard. It's funny, business people use a lot of these, really? And I think that's where I picked them up almost more from Texas. Some guy, we were on the phone call, and I used to write some of these down. I'm like, oh, I never heard that one. And he's like, we'll be talking about an issue. He's like, well, how about we put this in the parking lot for a while and come back to it or whatever, stuff like that. I'm like, what? And then it kind of makes sense, but uh-huh. You're like, I've never heard that. Texas sayings, though, goodness, I don't, it's one of those weird things, you aren't even aware you say them, probably, so I probably have a blind spot in my head to those. You could probably tell me better than myself.
So what would be your favorite one that you use almost daily? Is there a particular phrase, or?
I use y'all a lot, that's not a phrase, really, but I go to you guys, I do them both. I don't know, what were some of the, you said you heard five, throw them back to me.
You mentioned the fire hose is the one that came to me. There was your skimmers and divers, but
that was from a book.
Might not necessarily be a phrase that came directly from Texas. And then as we were walking over here, you mentioned another one, and I'm spacing out on it now.
But it was six of one, half dozen of another.
But you had
and then actually this is a Wisconsin one. Okay. I'd never heard of. A girl I dated up here introduced me to it. As far as she used to say it, I was like, what? But she's like a horse apiece.
A horse apiece.
Which is the same thing, evidently, as six of one, half dozen of another. I still argue that point. But, that was one of hers. It's weird because I don't even realize I'm picking them up when I do it. And I think that happens, actually, that type of speech happens more. Although I think you're right, Southerners probably do it, especially West Texan people. I'm from East Texas, Southeast Texas. But they have the greatest ones. I have a couple that do pop in my head but aren't PC enough to it's not PC, but they involve words that probably shouldn't be put on the internet for public consumption. We curse freely in the South, so as it goes. In business too, a lot of people use those types of phrases, mm-hmm. and that just that type of language. It's a less precise conversation than what you would have in science. And that actually, I'll work in one more thing about this job as a potential thing you need to have comfort with here too, is that may be a struggle, and this is something that as PhDs and as postdocs, I've heard that industry sometimes looks at, and as potential drawback, potential worry, depending where you're headed, mm-hmm. is that you need to have all the information to be able to move forward. Because in your scientific career, you can do that. You can gather information until you have everything to really arrive at a crystal answer. Businesses, be they industry, be they what I do now, especially, I have to make decisions based on whatever information I can get, and it's never adequate. And I have to be comfortable with making that call. Because you can't wait. A decision has to be made. You have to make the best one and move forward. Mm-hmm. That's an important thing that actually a PhD doesn't necessarily teach you. But I would advise, if you're in an interview, perhaps touching upon, because I've heard out there in the broader world outside of academia that that's a perception of PhDs,
yes.
That you would want to address, not directly, but just obliquely, let them know that you're able to handle that and move forward and make your good decisions. So along those lines, they don't have the precise language. They speak more in these generalities, and they'll make decisions based on these generalities. Okay. So I think that's where a lot of those phrases come from.
Okay. Well, that coming full circle, it makes complete sense. You were able to integrate that last off-the-cuff question into the interview as a whole. So, I want to thank Mark again for spending some time with us and going through, sharing his history and his advice and wisdom. And if there are any parting words from Mark, we can say our goodbyes and hopefully, everybody is able to listen and you get something out of this. I know I've sure gained quite a lot out of talking to Mark. And if there's anything else...
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to say thanks for having me, Brian. I appreciate it. A lot of people helped me out along the way. And I think I was always surprised at how much people were willing to help along the way. And then that just karma in the world as you help people out as well. And you want those networks to be established, your coworkers, your friends. And it's not that it's a quid pro quo, mm-hmm. but really that karma comes back around. So I've had a lot of help, and I appreciate the opportunity to pay some of it back. So thank you a lot, and good luck to everybody.
Great. Thank you. I'm Brian Jarecki for the Postdoc Way. Thanks for listening.